The whole thing about the Tree of Life, really, is that it is one, you know, there's lots of parts to it, and how we're looking at it in this course is we're focusing on a particular path at a time, so we're looking at one particular conjunction of spheres at each time. But actually the whole tree is at work all the time. It's one organism. And so when we... And because it's one organism, although our problem is because of the obstructions in our nature and the resistances in nature, we can't actually experience it as this, as one thing. What we experience is our partial senses of the tree, things we know, things that we're confused by, things that we just don't know. And the point of using something like the tree really is so that we have a template that enables our consciousness to work out where our consciousness gets restricted or blocked, and how to unblock those restrictions, so the whole tree can come into that place of balance that we were talking about yesterday. And from that place of balance, then all kinds of things become possible. Because what we're talking about with the tree is a series of conversations between the different parts of ourselves, the different parts of the universe. Now, when there is blockage in one part of the tree, that the whole energy of the tree is shifted. So that one path may have very little energy moving down it, therefore that will mean that energy flows differently in other parts of the tree, so other parts of the tree will get overemphasized. Some spheres will be, so rather than the spheres being of equal kind of size and clearly and properly kind of communicating, one becomes smaller, one becomes larger, one becomes dominant, one becomes submissive. And so, therefore, the constant flow of the tree gets interrupted. And just as in nature, a tree will grow in maybe in quite a crooked kind of way. And you know, and in some cases, when trees do that, literal trees do that, they often need the help of tree surgeons, because sometimes they fall over because they're growing in a one-sided way, or they can't, or somewhere the balance between the rootstock and the branches are off. So the branch, so there's overgrowth on top and not enough growth underneath. So there's all kinds of issues like, and all of this is part of, if we think of come back to this path between Hochmah and Tiferet, where we're looking really at that creative will coming into manifestation, coming into duality, and finding a balance point. Or in the shadow path, this confused, disorganized will, actually creating centers that operate autonomously in a kind of imperial and oppressive sort of way. So not attending to the health of the whole. You know, I mean, physical illness of cancer being the literal version of that, where cancer, you know, expands, develops more cells like itself to the complete detriment of the host or host organism, the body. So there's a... So the whole point of working with the tree, really, or wherever we work with the tree, whatever place we're looking at, we're working also with the whole of the tree. Now, with the whole astral travel image is quite interesting, really, because there's a whole one of the difficult territories really around ideas like astral travel. Is the glamour that gets associated with that. When we're talking about this astral travel, we're really just talking about entering the inner worlds, working with the inner worlds, working with the subtle aspect of the outer worlds, and learning to work with, learning to trust the perceptual capacities of the inner body, of our inner senses. And the As with everything else, one of the central things about working with the Tree of Life is finding that place of balance. So that inevitable question that comes in with any inner experience, really, is, am I imagining this? Am I making? And really, the meaning is not imagining. It's, am I making it up? Am I lost in fantasy? Now, and to really discover that, there are two things that really help that. One is to really know our instinctive tendencies. So if our instinctive tendency is to vanish into fantasy as an escape, well, that's an important thing to know. So when we have a sense of being in some happy, beautiful kind of place, but we feel a bit unsure about it, then we should maybe think about, okay, I know I have a tendency to do this. So let me look at this. Does this feel substantial and real? So as we look, and so the second bit is, as we inquire into that, does it feel, and again, you just have to trust your immediate experience. You know, so am I dissociating? Am I going off to the happy place? So if I understand why I go off to that happy place, I maybe normally do it because I'm feeling overwhelmed and scared, or it's something that reminds me of the past that I want to get away from. So then if I look into that present experience, I look into, well, is that there? Am I frightened by something? And if that's not there, that's a sign, well, okay, well, it probably isn't. Maybe it isn't that. Maybe it's something else. And then you get interested in that something else. The thing about the problem always with the internal dialogue is its automatic and swift nature, right? So that sense of, you know, this is the great image the Buddha gives us about the self being a ring of fire created by a torch that's being whirled very fast in the night. Now, it's a brilliant image, because if you literally do that, you don't see it, because of this tug, you don't see a torch, you literally see a solid ring of fire. If you were to touch it, it would feel like a solid ring of fire, because it's moving so fast, and you'd feel burned, you'd jump away from it. But the solidity of both the sense of self, and then the sense of the universe that self is embedded in, is caused by the momentum of our lives. By the speedy movement. So the movement is so fast, so immediate, it just feels real. It just feels solid. So as we were talking about yesterday, as we start to interrupt this, as we start to bring other qualities in, as this alchemical kind of work proceeds, what starts to happen is that solidity starts to wobble. Now, when something very fast starts to wobble, it can be quite disturbing. It can go off in odd directions, that weird stuff can happen, both inwardly and outwardly. Because the whole thing about the internal dialogue is not just an internal process, we're also controlling our perceptions, we're also controlling our sense of the world around us. So as that kind of grip starts to loosen, our sense of time and space starts to, because one of the fundamental knots, if you like, that ties us into this whole sense of knowing where we are in time and space. So that meditation that we looked at today, that really brings attention both into place and space, and into the sense of time as a dimension of consciousness, starts to loosen that fundamental knot. And so instead of knowing who I am, where I am, when I am, we start to transfer the sense of security to the sense of the sense of awareness itself. Now, as that happens, that the grip on time and space starts to loosen, we start to experience things, feel like you could say, before they happen. It's like Holly was saying about on this course, picking, doing things or being aware of things, and then they come into the course. And in that moment, what Holly's describing is being in that place of time as a place of consciousness and as a sense of consciousness, and therefore aware of something before it manifests in linear time, because it is in that more fluid kind of place. What also can happen is strange things can happen, because we're not imposing on our environment and on our sense of self a particular way of the universe operating. And strange things can be very physical sometimes. I was just remembering many years ago when Ali and I had our first flat in Cardiff. We'd had a nice carpet put down, and we didn't have any furniture. And we walked in one day, and the room was strewn with green wheat. We the only person who had access to that was the landlord's agent, who was not a man who was agriculturally, he was a very seedy guy. And I checked with him just to say, and he just looked at me as a crazy. But you know, it's, you know, what would be more appropriate than beginning a new flat together than a sheaf of green wheat being spread on the carpet? What's that about? I mean, it's freaky, you know, it's still freaky, you know, when I think about it, because there's no real, I have no idea how that got there. It was, and these things that Jung would call synchronicity, and it's a term that gets abused really by, you know, people want synchronicity, so they create, clearly in Glastonbury, they create coincidences. But the thing about genuine synchronicity is it freaks you out. It's very precise. And I remember once, I was working with a group in Israel, in high summer in Israel, and we were working doing a meditation about working with water and the fertility of the land and we completed our meditation, and it came to rain. Not for very long, admittedly, but for about, I don't know, 3-4 minutes, it rained. And again, that's all, you know, everybody's very excited, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, what's going on here? Because actually, the thing about genuine synchronicity is it disturbs you. And it disturbs you because you're suddenly entering into a more fluid, more mysterious, more responsive universe than you feel comfortable with. So this process of the meditation today, really, where we're looking at this very particular knot that holds us in our place, that holds our perceptions in their familiar shape, and literally holds the universe in the familiar shape. What we're inviting in now is a different kind of conversation.
Could I just comment? The loosening of time and space happens in trauma, doesn't it? When people are in the middle of a car accident or something, they that's what they say, time slowed down, or, you know, I suppose because they're thrown back totally into the body and into the sense of self. And other things, they, you know, they have distortions of their normal perceptions all around them.
Well, I think, yes. Well, in a way, it's interesting, I think, what happened. I mean, I was just remembering I was travelling back from Dartmoor once, and my car turned over. And I skidded and then oversteered, went up a bank and flipped onto my roof and I really remember that sense of time, like, vividly, what the sense of the car spiralling and being turned upside down seemed to take forever. you know, because you're suddenly in that life and death moment, you're suddenly very present in awareness, and so you're paying very, very acute attention. So this kind of this weird crash, and then the world upside down, and I'm hanging upside down from a seatbelt. You know, so there's a sort of, so in a way it's a good, you know, and the problem, you know, what kind of happens with when you get a shocking and things like that, unless you've been able to kind of integrate them later, they form little kind of eddies, if you like, in the pool of the, in the spinning pool wheel of the internal dialogue that operate autonomously. And so you get with classic PTSD, you get the eruption of those memories, the eruption of those things into the normal sense of self in a way that disables. So one of the things when you treat PTSD, you get somebody feeling very safe, and then you little by little enter the traumatic vortex in order to dissolve it. Now, this is a specialized example of the deeper work of dissolving the whole of the internal dialogue, which is what exercises like the one that we've just looked at and other exercises do. The, you know, in a way that this little meditation of locating ourselves in space and then reversing time. It's you know, this is one of the very first exercises Ernest Butler ever taught me, and of course you don't pay enough attention to it when you're young and you're kind of, you know, it's a bit of a boring exercise. It's also quite a hard exercise. So you see, you know, because what Ernest would teach is that when you go to sleep every night, you replay the events of the day backwards. And the idea being that you're cleansing your consciousness from the aspect of the internal dialogue that you've been engaged with in the daytime, and hopefully in that process discovering that time is a dimension of awareness, and that can be worked with. You know, in a way, and that goes for personal time, but it also goes for transpersonal time. It goes to collective experience, because when we've come into the sense of the collective psyche, then that's a collective history. That too is embedded in consciousness. It's part of the psyche, the collective psyche, really, that Jung refers to. And these collective energies, collective aspects of history, collective aspects of PTSD, we could even say, sit there in that constant dialogue, having their own contribution to make. You know, we think of what's happening in Israel-Palestine at the moment, the collective history of the Jews and the Arabs in that area, the energies that created the Holocaust, that created the Nakba, the great disaster for the Palestinians, are at play. So those conversations are at play in this current crisis and conflict. Similarly, if we look at Ukraine and Russia, the collective traumas of both countries are somewhere contributing to the current situation. And so this apparently simple process of working with this deep sense of will and dissolving the normal sense of holding ourselves in time and space, and finding a way to center ourselves in awareness rather than the definition of who I am and when I am and how I am. Then creates a much more fluid, creative situation where we are available to the, if you like, the deeper energies of the tree, because who we really are is the center point in Ketta. You know, that that sort of I am who that I am, I will be that which I will be. This all comes out of the center point of Ketta, which manifests through the will and love of Hokma and Bina. And continually and constantly that quality of Ketta, which in itself is a, if you like, a focus point of the unmanifest energies, is constantly emerging, trying to express itself fully and clearly in relationship to whatever is happening now. And what's happening now is everything is happening now. The universe is universing now. And because the universe is a deeply interconnected place, our part of the in that constant conversation is crucial. And the extent to which we can be inaccurate, we can enter accurately and clearly into the conversation that's emerging through us, is the extent to which we enable the universe to work as it should and wants to. The extent to which we're not able to fully embody who we are and what we are and listen to that deep kind of presence that's trying to emerge through us is the extent to which we build a kind of resistance or a distortion into the universal pattern. It's that phrase that we get from Charles Williams, the organic body sings together. The sense of the universe as one organic body. You know, which is, you know, so that just as, you know, our bodies, our physical bodies need to sing together so that our systems are in harmony, so that we can most fully then kind of be ourselves, operate as ourselves. I'm just going to read that poem again, The Organic Body of Empire, because it's not an easy poem, but it gives that the... actually, I'm going to read the prelude first of all to the whole... It's Charles Williams' Arthurian epic, because it gives us an idea where Williams comes from, where the Arthurian ethic, whole Arthurian thing comes from. So this is the prelude. Recalcitrant tribes heard orthodox wisdom sprang in Caucasia and Thule. The glory of the emperor stretched to the ends of the world. In the season of midmost Sophia, the word of the emperor established a kingdom in Britain. They sang in Sophia the immaculate conception of wisdom. Carbonek, Camelot, Caucasia were gates and containers, intermediations of light. Geography breathing geometry, the double-fledged logos, double-fledged word. The blind rulers of Logres nourished the land on a fallacy of rational virtue. The seals of the saints were broken, the chairs of the table reeled. Galahad quickened in the mercy. But history began. The Muslims stormed Byzantium. Lost was the glory, lost the power and the kingdom. Call on the hills to hide us, lest men said in the city. The Lord of Charity ride in the starlight, soul flash of the emperor's glory. Evil and goods were twins once in the alleys of Isfahan. The Muslim crying Allah I Allah destroyed the dualism of Persia. Caucasia fell to the Muslim. The Mamluk seized the ancient corn land of empire. Union is breached. The Imams stand in Sophia. Good is God, the Muezzin calls. But lost is the light on the hills of Caucasia. Glory of the emperor. Glory of substantial being. Now let's stay with this poem actually for this bit. I'll come back to the other one later. Now, Charles Williams has his own dialect, really, as I was saying yesterday. But what he is describing here, and this image of Sophia. Sophia is the Holy of Holies. Sophia is that kind of sanctuary place where the divine ideas are coming into being. Now, when he's talking about recalcitrant tribes, he's not talking about anything external. He's talking about those aspects of ourselves and the world that resist that deeper kind of conversation. So the orthodox wisdom that arises is not the orthodoxy of Christianity. It's the energy of life, the energy of creativity arising from the deep play, from the divine creative energy the orthodoxy that is meant here is the orthodoxy of natural law. Things happening because they happen, not because of a belief or dogma or having to sign up to anything. It's like the laws of the orthodox wisdom is the law, like the laws of chemistry and physics, biology. You know, this is what arises. And Caucasia and Thule. Now he uses these images. Thule is the head, and Caucasia is the bottom. Partly, as I've said, there's this like sexual kink going on with Williams in that around the bottom, so he's very bottom focused. But what he is meaning by that is the creative ideas, of the divine, come into substantial physical existence. The sense of the fleshiness of the hills of Caucasia, so it's about the incarnation of the divine ideas through the orthodox wisdom, which is in a way the manifestation of the balanced tree. And what he goes on to say is again, we're looking at the origins of the Arthurian myth. So the emperor, so this is this figure manifesting out of Hokmah through the kind of, if you like, the temple of the art, the inner sanctuary, manifesting a kingdom in Britain. This is Malchut in Logres. So this is the sense of the manifestation of that deeper life in actuality, in physicality. And the script, they sing in Sophia of the Immaculate Conception of Wisdom, of that. So this is this image that arises out of the art of the of what can happen. This is this kind of, if you like, image. More that it's not really an image in a yesodic sense yet. It's the creativity of the supernals generating a child that will manifest in Malchut as Logres, as Camelot, as the perfect kingdom. And this poem goes on to name Carbonek, Camelot, and Caucasia. So Carbonek is the Grail castle. So basically Camelot we would say is in Tiferet. Carbonek is in Tiferet. Camelot, which is the vision of the perfect kingdom, is in Yesod. Caucasia is the actual substantial manifestation of that. So what the poet is doing here is saying here these images you find in the Grail stories are gates and containers, intermediations of light. So these are, so you get from the divine center in Keter, we get the in Sophia, we get the sort of the vision of that which can be, which then enters into the creative balancing point of Tiferet, becomes the image of the perfect kingdom in Yesod, and then in Caucasia comes physically into being. So then he goes on to say is then what he deals with is the way in which that goes wrong. That's because what we're dealing with all the time with, and what our actual human situation is, with that sense of that deep will, that deep creativity that is always trying to emerge through us, and then something has gone wrong. The blind rulers of Logres nourished the land on a fallacy of rational virtue. The seals of the saints were broken, the chairs of the table reeled. So instead of keeping the connection between Caucasia, Camelot, Carbonek, Sophia, there the nourishing on the land on the, so the, a blindness happens, right? So literally the abyss appears, literally the veil of the temple happens, and then instead of that nourishment coming from the deep and spiritual place, it comes from an image, an idea of that, the rational fallacy of virtue. And the effect of that is that the seals of the saints are broken, so that sense of connection with the great pool of saints. The chairs of the table, the chairs of the round table, the chairs of the table, of, which is also the table of the mass, the table of nourishment, it falls apart. So that kind of connection with that deeper place, the connection really that with the Grail Castle, the connection with Sophia falls, that the chairs of the table, the round table, that is the place out of which the, if you like, the kind of the divine light descends into the Grail that's at the center of the round table, which then inspires the knights who are aspects of will and intention to go out and create and recreate Logres, falls apart because the connections are broken. And then we are reminded that Galahad, who is the great Grail Knight, is the person who restores this. Galahad quickens in the mercy. But history began, and now we get something that's often misunderstood in Williams. The Muslims stored Byzantium. This is not an anti-Muslim statement. The way he uses the word Muslim here is a denial of the incarnation. So he's saying here is spirituality that affirms unity but denies denies and cannot deal with. It's much more like a Gnostic spirituality that cannot deal with physicality. And so that sense of the lost is the power, lost the glory, lost the kingdom. And it's thine is the power, the glory, and the kingdom forever and ever is the final end of the Lord's Prayer, which is the act of incarnation. And it's what we find in the Kabbalistic cross, thine ate, malchut, the kingdom, the power and the glory of Geburah and Gedula. So that sense of that incarnating kind of energy is denied into a sort of a Gnostic retreat away from the full embodiment of the light. And he goes on to say to look at then what happens there. Evil and good were twins once in the alleys of Isfahan. So this sense of opposites, which are then subsumed by the Allah illallah, the unity of the problem with his way of understanding Allah illallah is the unity of the divine, but cannot embrace the multiplicity because it is not allowing the concept of incarnation to fully kind of manifest. And that's why he says Caucasia fell to the Muslim, the Mamluks seized the ancient corn land of empire, union is breached, the Imams stand in Sophia. Good is God, the Bezuin calls, but lost is the light on the hills of Caucasia, glory of the empire, glory of substantial being. So it's, none of that is anti-Muslim, and certainly, if you look at the Sufi traditions, they're very powerful traditions of embodiment and sexuality there. But what he's saying here is the danger, one of the dangers of spirituality is that you lose the Malkut, you lose the place where the glory of substantial being manifests. And it said,
Can I say something, Ian?
Yes, of course, Jenny, of course.
What you're saying, I'm trying to make sense of your words.
Yeah.
I'm finding it so hard to come back from that other place. And it's like I need to speak to make contact.
Yeah, go on.
So that I'm back in the world because I'm in that other place and when you stopped me saying the poems, I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear coming into that headspace anymore. And if I'm in that other place, it's both exciting and so scary because there are no boundaries anymore. And I don't know what will come into my life or how my life will be or who I will be. So I think what I'm saying is that I try to listen to the words of the poetry. They're rolling away from me. I can't grasp them. And I just need to put my glasses on so I can see you and make that, because it's so hard between that place and the world.
Okay, so tell me about the hardness of that place, Jenny. So we've got the world. So what's the world?
It's no connection.
Okay. So tell me about the no connection.
So, as you know, in the past, it's like I've been more connected with here and haven't been able to get there, wherever there is.
Yeah.
And now it's like I'm there.
Okay. So can you feel your body, Jenny? Can you feel your body?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I can.
Good.
So now I'm being very foolish.
No, don't go there. Don't do that. Actually, you're doing something quite important, not just for you, but for everybody. So just feel your body and feel the other place and feel the world and feel your body as the container and the mediation point.
See, I don't want to lose that.
No, you won't. Feel your body, feel the other place. Keep leaning into the other place and feel your body.
What I did, and remembering what I experienced right at the beginning of I don't know, at some point in the morning, realizing, oh, that place is right here inside me.
Good. Yeah.
And it was so uncluttered by all the stuff.
Yep.
So if I remember that, it isn't out there, it is here.
Okay, good. So feel it, so find it there again now.
Yes. Yes, I think I feel more, I can't say I'm there, but okay. I can sense the possibility
okay.
of
Good.
Being the in the two places.
Okay. What I want to suggest to you as well is that you are completely resonating with the heart of that poem. Because yes, because what the poem talks about and what the end and what it doesn't matter whether you understand it, you're completely resonating with the energy of it. Because what the poem talks about is what happens when that creative energy, that divine energy, doesn't come fully into the body, into manifestation. Because what happens is that then we get lost in the split in between. Right, that sense of there's being a gulf between the world and this more magical kind of place.
Yeah.
Unless it comes into the body, into what the poet calls the glory of substantial being, physical being, then something really is lost. So what you just, extraordinarily what you did, is you came in at exactly the right point and showed us what happens when we don't have that sense of that connection with the physicality, that connection of the spirit coming right down into the body.
So is this the abyss?
Well, it's yes, we are then left in the abyss. Yes, exactly, because we don't have any ground. Right, so we're left in that in that place where there's, and in a way what the poet is warning about, that actually even though something can look very beautiful, if it doesn't come down into the ground, if it doesn't come down into the body, into this sense of physically being here and being then something is really lost and something really difficult happens, and we're lost in between. So where you were then was lost in between.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
No ground at all. So you're flooded with all kinds of stuff, really, and kind of. Whereas actually, when you come into that sense of feeling that other place in the body, then it's a completely different experience.
Yes, and then what helped me to come more into the body was making the contact, calling out to you.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
No, that's right, because when we're in that place, right, when we're in that split place, we do need help. We need, because the problem is then we're in that spiraling kind of place where that gets bigger and bigger and more and stronger and so, and there's no ground. There's nothing to hang on to. There's nothing to operate from. So we tend just to spin further and further out. So by you making contact and just reaching out, we then come into, and then quite quickly you come into a different place.
Yes. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah, and it's really important you get that you're resonating with the heart of the poem, because that's exactly what I was talking about in the poem. So it doesn't matter whether you understand the word, that doesn't matter. You are completely in the energy of it.
Yeah, but the advantage of it being recorded is I can go back and I can listen to the words.
You can. Exactly, that's right. But actually, the interesting thing that just happened in terms of this powerful interconnectedness that we're looking at, you were completely in the territory that I was describing through the poem. And again, it's very precise, because at the very moment I'm talking about that bit is when you say, "Oh, can you tell me? Can we talk?" Right? Because you're in. So we're right in that moment in the bit of the poem where actually the physicality has been lost, and the sense of connection between the spirit and the body has gone. So that's the moment. That's the moment where you came in. So that was just perfect bit of timing, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Good. Okay. So we've got 5 minutes now, maybe for our lunch. So let's just see if anybody else has got anything on their minds.
Something that Jenny said in terms of it's hard to sort of get a grip on the mind, so the poem and the concepts, the mind. So are you purposefully holding these two opposites? So sometimes we're going into the imagination and then we're coming back into the mind, and is it on purpose so that we're not going more into one or the other? We're trying to get a balance.
Yeah, it is. Of course it is. Yes, I'm moving. Yes, exactly. So sometimes we're working with the body, sometimes we're working with the imagination, sometimes we're using ideas from the mind. So we're, in a way, that's the way spiritual systems work, really, in that they work with them. Basically, we work with the mind, the feelings, the imagination, and the body. So we're using exercises, a call on different aspects of those in order to get us to find a sort of a balance between the different aspects of ourselves. Yeah, it's important.
I was thinking about how, I think this is what I understood as part of what you were describing in response to Jenny's experience, that the poem seems to be about how when we get caught up with sort of like idealisms, ideologies, we can't love all of the difference and diversity that we are part of. So it felt like it's quite a sort of relevant in our contemporary lives, that we get so much enrichment from diversity and differences, but we need to be able to be in the body to meet those, rather than thinking about this kind of like ideological place where everything's untouchable.
No, well, the great thing about the body is it can hold two different experiences simultaneously in the way the mind can't. Mind can only really hold one experience at a time. So in the body we can experience something where there is both attraction and repulsion, or agreement and disagreement, whereas the mind finds that very, very hard to do. But the mind, supported by the body and the kind of union of mind and body, means that our mind becomes much more fluid, much more flexible. And if we unite mind, feeling, and imagination and body, then we really are producing a kind of, if you like, a field of holding and awareness that has got enormous capacity for movement, for flexibility and creativity. And in a way, that's the the problem when, you know, of the problem of ideology is in the word ideology. The idea becomes primary, and the idea becomes dominant, and the, you know, so if somebody declares themselves to be a kind of pagan Muslim, I don't know what that would be, right? But I've discovered the truth. I am a jihadi for Muslim paganism, which doesn't exist, of course. But if I take that idea, then becomes an obsessing idea, that then becomes an idol, that then co-opts our normal ways of thinking, feeling, imagining, and physical experience in the service of the idea. And I think that's the problem of any ideology, really. Human beings are, ideas should be at the service of that deeper kind of presence, really, and of course all ideas have, both, like everything else in duality, have advantages and disadvantages. So in a certain sense, the inner work is very much about finding the balance between mind, body, imagination, and physicality, you know, and feeling, you know, so that the what is created then is a sort of is a kind of a grail, really, that can both hold experience and manifest in any kind of way that is necessary and needed to be.
Mm. But I was thinking that about the whole Palestine and Israel thing. There is two groups of people who have been persecuted and need a home.
Yeah, totally, completely. Totally.
And that they don't seem to,
yeah.
They are, whatever their ideologies are, they seem to see each other as enemies, and yet they're actually much more close.
Oh God, totally. And if, you know, as a stranger, if you're wandering around somewhere like Jerusalem, you know, obviously as an informed stranger, I know where I am, but initially the Arabs and Jews, they look similar, they sound similar, the languages even are not that much, Hebrew and Arabic are not much more similar to each other than they are to other languages, you know, so there's this extraordinary thing, really, of an exactly that similar history, both needing a home, both dispossessed, and both with histories of persecution, and yet that becomes the thing that divides them and keeps them in a state of constant war with each other. And in a way that and of course the way our world is organized is we like that. So, you know, there are political cultures use that, our media culture uses that. You know, so when the other energy of uniting opposites appears in places like that, it doesn't get noticed. And I've never ever forgotten, really, being at the night of when 9/11 happened, and I was shocked. So we were walking down to downtown Jerusalem, and at the Jaffa Gate, there were a whole load of Arabs who were lighting candles for the dead and were very sad about what had happened. Now, you didn't see any of that on TV. What you saw on TV were people, were Arabs in Jerusalem, celebrating the death of the great Satan. And, of course, that's another problem, really, with the kind of society, global society, projects images of dualism and conflict rather than images of rather than the more deeper human quality, where we don't want to do that, actually. But, you know, there's a whole kind of, you know, if I think of, you know, certainly many of the people I've known, they can get very angry in that situation because it's a very difficult situation. But mostly people are, you know, just quite nice, really. You know, they kind of want to get on with their lives, and so it is one of the, you know, great tragedies of human life, really, that out of these places of separation within us, that then these enormous external kind of separation, ongoing, the painful and difficult things happen.
There's that really good kind of a film or a series. It's by the guy who did Wolf.
Oh yeah.
It's based on, it's like a love story. With, you know, someone from Palestine, someone from Israel.
Mm.
God, I wish I can remember what it's called. It's really, really good.
It sounds really good.
Was it called Key?
I can't remember. It was that girl that played, for a period of time, she was in The Crown as the Queen. I've forgotten her name as well.
Oh, I know who you mean.
Claire Foy.
Hmm?
Claire Foy.
Claire Foy. Claire Foy, that's it. Might have been The Key, actually.
It might have been.
It goes between the Second World War and present day, I think.
Yeah, she's looking for
her home. The key was given when they displaced the Palestinians, and there was, yeah, it was something about the ownership of the house. I can vaguely remember it, and I'm not sure if it's the right film, but it was certainly a good film, The Key. It gave background to how complicated it is. And then coming forward into this time, but with flashbacks to the Second World War. Or just afterwards, when they were settling.
Well, if it wasn't that, it was a very, very similar one. And is this all something to do with, you know, Malkuth, like Gaia, the body coming into... Because there's something about the crown and the kingdom, and how they kind of almost like reverse sometimes.
Yeah, they do. So it really is about this whole kind of territory of kind of the... So if we think of the union of Keter and Malkuth, okay, and you know, so in a certain sense, if we look at really fully incarnating, well, this is the fusion of Malkuth and Keter. So and this is the crown and the kingdom and the being in the same place. But it requires the mediation of Tiferet, which is the mediation of that kind of sovereign kind of presence. And in a certain sense, that's what the whole Arthurian myth is supposed to be about, in a way, in that the king enables the kingdom to come into being. The king being this kind of center point of presence of Tiferet, that then enables the energy of the crown to unfold itself fully in, fully in Malkuth. And in a way, you know, that's that sense then of Camelot being this Eden on earth, you know, this kind of... you know, you get this image, and we get it in that, you know, the musical Camelot, where he's talking about the rain falling gently and in the night and refreshing, so the things working as they should work in an almost Edenic kind of paradise, in a sense. You know, so in a way that's the deeper intention behind the whole thing. It's really about the transfiguration of matter, the sense where spirit and matter become one thing, not separate. But that's the deepest version of that, really. Okie dokie, let's have lunchtime. Let's have a break for our lunch and come back at 1:30. So have a nice lunch, everybody, and I'll see you shortly. Bye bye.
I'm going to see Becky at the food festival.
Oh, wow.
It's just up the road. I've had people tramping past my window up there. She's got a gin stall. So I'm just popping up to say hello to her.
Oh, that'll be fun. That'll be nice just to see her. Give her our love, Penny.
I know.
Yeah.
I will.
Yeah.
See you soon.
See you soon, honey. Okay.